Blog Talk Radio.
Your trouble ain't over. Your trouble has just begun. You're walking in shadows. Your heart is on the run. You may know who I am, but you don't know what's mine. Call me the devil. Call me by another name. You're looking for redemption, but you call me just the same. I know all your dirty secrets. I can't cause your greatest shame.
Trouble.
forms of rare brain disease.
The spirit and brain didn't have a high property. So pretty much when they looked at the CT scan, it was nothing included.
But life got even tougher after a seemingly minor incident in December of 2010 when he was pulled over by police and ticketed for expired license plates.
I was coming from the hospital. We had been staying with the hospital. And as I come into town, they had a traffic checkpoint.
Timothy's wife, Christy, had also gotten tickets for two traffic infractions, and both were ordered to appear in the Childersburg Municipal Court. The fugitives told the judge about their hospitalized son, and both were found not guilty, as these court documents show. But the judge ruled the two still had to pay court costs of about $500. During this period, Timothy Fugit said he was spending so much time at the hospital with his son that he couldn't hold down a job, and with his wife also not working, they couldn't afford to pay the court costs. So their case was turned over to Judicial Correction Service, a private company that collects fines for the city. Fugit said that Judicial Correction Services, known as JCS, told him that he and his wife could be jailed if they didn't pay what they owed.
That was fine. I'll tell you, if you can't pay, then no issue. It won't be real.
Is that scary?
Of course.
Fugit says he did the best he could to pay off his family's fine, but says when he couldn't continue to pay, and he and his wife missed at least a court date, they were arrested in jail.
I felt like a criminal. I didn't sell drugs. I didn't break anything one time, but people threw anything. I had an expired tag.
So you and your wife were found not guilty of the traffic fine, but still you were being arrested.
We were being arrested, yes. I was very upset, very angry.
They were released several hours later when a relative paid a portion of what they owed. That incident contributed to the Fugit's decision to become part of a lawsuit against Judicial Correction Services and the City of Childersburg. The suit alleges that incarcerating people who can't pay their fines violates the Constitution. Some experts argue that jail time is legal for those who don't make a good faith effort to pay their fine. In 1971, the Supreme Court ruled that the Constitution prohibits imposing a jail term solely because the defendant is indigent and cannot forthwith pay the fine in full.
That's exactly what's happening.
David Dinelli is the Deputy Legal Director of the Southern Poverty Law Center, a nonprofit civil rights organization that is not involved in the Fugit lawsuit, but has represented others in similar situations. Dinelli estimates that 1,000 people every month are going to jail in Alabama if they cannot afford to pay the fine.
Everyone thinks that there is prison behind us. It isn't. As a matter of practice, and in some cases policy, the court has one question. Can you pay the fine? If you can't, then you have to get it out in jail. That is unconstitutional unless the court first conducts an inquiry into whether they're indigent and the causes for their inability to pay the fine. Routinely, what's happening here is that no such inquiry is undertaken.
Did anyone in the court ever try and assess whether or not you put the fourth pay the fees?
It was real fast.
Collecting fines is more important than ever because many cities face budget shortfalls. But these same cities don't have the personnel, so increasingly they turn to what are known as private probation. That's where Judicial Correction Service is.
We were approached by the bounded.
Childersburg officials declined to speak. So we met with Stephen Boone, the finance director for Mountain Brook, a city neighboring Childersburg that also hires Judicial Correction Service. His court is one of over 1,000. In at least 12 states across the country that hired a private probation company, according to human rights. Judicial Correction Services collects funds at no cost to the cities it works for.
They're helping us to become more efficient. They're helping us ensure that we don't get backlogged and delinquent. It may ultimately get so old and people move away that we'll never play. So it's, I think, win-win. I think private probation has
Republican State Senator Pam Ward is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and has been following the growing trend of probation. Not only does Ward support the use of such companies, he believes the industry will continue to grow.
Now, I will tell you this. I think the trend of privatization in the area of collection, I think that will continue all across the country. So you see a concentrated effort to put more money into the collection services to collect money.
But these private debt collectors are by definition in business to make money. And even though they don't charge the city anything, they charge offenders, like Timothy Fugit, $45 a month plus a $10 startup fee until the debt is fully paid off. This on top of the $500 in court costs that Fugit already owed.
Can you tell me if you were making an effort to pay these off?
We weren't. Yes, sir. You know, even though, you know, I was making the effort, I wasn't getting very far. Still, all these fees adding up, but I wasn't getting enough money.
Still, 4 months after their initial court date, documents show that the exhibits scraped together enough to pay off almost $300 of the $500 they owe in court costs. But then things went from bad to worse. In June of 2011, their son Cole died. A month later, their house that had been in the family for generations was foreclosed. At this point, the exhibits say that they were consumed with grief and were missing their appointment. Timothy says he explained the difficult circumstances the family was under, but he says the JCS probation officer wouldn't work with him at all.
And it was all at one time. Should have called him once and I explained it all to them, but you know, it was either pay or still.
Being threatened with a jail sentence, did that help you come up with the money?
It helped me to try a little harder, but that's still the old thing that we put.
Over the next 8 months, with JCS monthly fees added up, the couple missed at least one court date each and would find additional fees for failing to appear. Then, warrants for their arrests were issued. By the time of their arrest in February 2012, Hughes had racked up $2,500 in additional court fees. Remember, all this began with three traffic violations for which they were found not guilty.
If you would have come up with the money that you owed, you did your correction service. And you may turn up for all of your reports with that and to the court. No,
it
doesn't.
It will good question. I was doing what I could do. A dying child, no steady job at that point because they were back to the hospital. I'm doing what I could do.
David Dinelli of the Southern Poverty Law Center says that people like the few that end up paying JCS off for years because all the additional fees and added fines they help through.
They're in a system in which all they are doing is paying JCS to just subtraction services on a monthly basis for the privilege of paying out of jail.
We asked legal scholar and Columbia Law Professor Gillian Metz to take a look at the lawsuit and to evaluate the constitutionality of private companies like the correction services collecting fines for citizens killed it. He has no involvement in the case.
Part of what the process requires is that you have new correction systems. And if the company that is imposing the fees and considering this service has a financial interest in your staying under the service, then that really calls their impartiality. And they have a financial interest.
Metzger also says the court is obligated to provide alternative options for companies that pay off a debt to society, such as community service, if he or she is in.
If you're not paying because the victim can't pay, then the court can't automatically do this. They have to do an investigation of the alternative arrangements in order to allow you to book off the time.
We reached out to JCS multiple times for an interview, but we never received a reply. But on its website, JCS says the lawsuit is based on. We also tried unsuccessfully several times to ask the mayor of Childersburg, B.J. Meeks. He was satisfied with the service of JCS at this time, but City Hall never responded to our request. So we went to a city council meeting to ask.
After speaking to some of the residents here, they feel like they're being threatened with a jail sentence if they don't pay their fines. And I wonder if you had a comment. Is it not unconstitutional to jail somebody who cannot pay their fees?
I don't know. There again, it's a $4,000. I know that.
Even State Senator Pam Ward, who supports the private program in the state, has concerns.
And what's common even exists is almost like a wild west. There is no regulation. If you're going to create a system that quote unquote is a debtor's prison, all you're doing is inviting yourself to a federal lawsuit.
As for the future, after being charged an initial court cost of about $500 for traffic violations, of which they were found not guilty, court documents provided by the Dubin's lawyer show that they paid almost $1,300 to the children's court. It's a number that doesn't even include all the additional monthly fees they paid to judicial correction service, a figure the city of Childersburg is fined to provide us due to that. Timothy Fugit says that his family still owes more money to the Judicial Corrections Service. How much? He's not sure. He says JCS stopped contacting him after the lawsuit was filed. While the Fugit case is still pending, since our story aired last spring, the Childersburg Municipal Court recently issued a standing order saying that in no case shall an indigent defendant be incarcerated based solely on his or her inability to pay fines. Fugit's attorney also told NewsHour that hundreds of Childersburg residents no longer have warrants out for their arrest, Judicial Corrections Service lawsuit. In a statement to NewsHour, the city of Childersburg says it is pleased with the action taken to transform the court, which was the subject of some negative press attention, into a model for other courts to follow. And Childersburg is not alone. The city of Montgomery, that also hired Judicial Corrections Service, has agreed to new policies to avoid jailing people who are too poor to pay minor fines. In November, a federal court approved a settlement for plaintiffs who were suing the city, alleging they were unlawfully jailed. The settlement requires Montgomery to stop contracting with Judicial Corrections Service.
Now, some ideas are some of the best left in the past, whether it's red warmers, bell bottoms, to the so-called Paleolithic diet. But there's one disturbing comeback that has flown largely under the radar, the return of debtor prisons. And it's happening right here in 21st century America. According to reports, more and more American citizens are winding up behind bars for debt, arrested, locked up, in some cases just for missing a huge settlement payment. By owing money, not a criminal offense. America abolished its debtor prisons, which we did used to have more than a century ago. What's really going on here? Are debtor prisons really, truly making a comeback? Well, for the answer, we decided to turn to Bryce Kroger. She's an assistant editor at the Medial 2.0 of Law at the Roosevelt Institute. And here's her case. It's clear that there's a huge jump in arrest warrants being used for debt collectors trying to collect their debt from ordinary citizens. As you said, America outlawed debtors' prisons back in the 1800s, so it's not that there's a prison now where people are being thrown to languish for not paying 60 cents like they used to be, but arrest warrants and jail time is being used as a punishment or a coercion to get people who aren't paying their bills or who are missing court appearances to pay up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, I mean, can't you argue that people need to learn how to live within their means and that there needs to be consequences for people who buy things with money that they don't have? I mean, you know, we're in an economic recession. We're in a crisis. There's a reason that we got to this point. Shouldn't there be consequences for bad action? Sure, there is no replacement for responsibility, and people do need to pay the bills and the loans that they take out. The problem is that over the past couple decades, people have seen their wages either stagnate or fall. And to plug that hole, Americans have been using credit and basically debt to pay for rent, to pay for food, to pay for clothes. And during the bubble buildup, that was all well and good. But now that the bubble burst, a lot of people are finding themselves in a difficult position. And of course, we need to encourage people to be paying back their loans, but throwing them in jail isn't actually going to solve anything because you're actually not able to go out and make money to pay back those debts. You're simply languishing in a prison. So, we need to be able to punish people who are being fraudulent, and we need to encourage people to pay the debts that they owe, but we also need to make sure that it's being done in an effective way. And from your reporting from the working side, what kind of people are essentially being thrown in jail for debt? I mean, are these usually criminals or are they more, I don't know, proper loans and sort of your neighbor down the street? It's a really wide range. I mean, some of them are sort of ordinary people. One of the problems is that the debt collection agencies aren't necessarily doing their job to let people know that they're being pursued for debt. So this could be someone who owes some money but isn't aware that they're being prosecuted until they're being arrested. And that's one of the biggest problems with the system, is that it's not really a system, that the information isn't being accurately spread. You know, in a free market system, it only works if everybody's got the right information at their hands. So, you know, it's guys who own money on car loans, it's moms who are trying to pay back credit card bills, and it can be as little as $85 to a couple thousand. Well, they're definitely using any tactics that they can. I mean, this is how they make their money. They buy these debts for pennies on the dollar and then use any means necessary to go after them. Sometimes it's through threatening jail time or arrest warrant, and sometimes it's just through plain old harassing people. The cops aren't really complicit in this. They have also protested because this is misusing their resources. They're having a hard time going after real crimes because there's this backlog of veterans that they're supposed to be going after, and you know, that costs them money, that costs them manpower. But it's not really a good way for these people to be going after getting their money back. I mean, there's always going to be the need to deal with fraudulent cases, people who are neglecting their bills and really just sort of running from them. But just as a means to try to coerce people to paying their bills, this seems like an ineffective use of their power. And have you had any sense of people finally catching on to this trend, that something may actually be done about it? Definitely. There's been some movement to make sure that when this is happening, that the debt collection agencies, like I said, they're not always letting people know that they're doing this. They're using long addresses and mailings are going to someone else. So the people who are actually being pursued don't even know about it until this arrest warrant comes. So there's been some movement to make sure that the debt collector has to prove that they tried to contact the person and actually contacted them before an arrest warrant is actually used, which would actually go a long way because then people are at least aware of what's happening and they can either choose to pay it back or, you know, if they don't, then things proceed, but at least they're given that opportunity. I mean, I don't understand how people can't just not get outraged about this, that these companies could go and knowingly not go after the information to these poor people who probably would actually pay the money if they knew that they could be thrown in jail for not doing it. I'm just surprised that there's not more outrage from politicians, from the media, from people who have gone through this. I think it's an industry that's sort of flown under the radar a bit. You know, you can sort of, in my mind, I put them together with maybe payday loans and pawn shops that have kind of outrageous practices or outrageous fees, and they prey upon the lower income people in our society. And like I said, the agencies like the FTC are out there trying to protect them, but they've just been stretched thin, starved of the manpower and the cash that they need. So there's just not the effective regulatory agencies keeping an eye on these people. I do think that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, once it's up and running, has achieved and actually sort of enacting its own rules. It's going to go a long way to dealing with these things. I'm sure this will be on their radar because they're out there to protect consumers. And with someone dedicated to that idea, I think that a lot of these practices will be uncovered and then addressed. But haven't we gotten into this financial crisis because the people that are elected and put on board to protect consumers and the economy have not done their job today? I mean, we don't exactly have a great track record in this country of protectors of Americans doing their job and federal regulators doing what they're supposed to do. Definitely. We definitely need a stronger regulatory system. I think that the financial reform bill that passed the Dodd-Frank Act is going a long way to reforming that system. There were too many loopholes. There were too many agencies that didn't have the authority they needed to go in and correct things. And I think the CFPB standing alone and focused just on consumers is exactly what we need here. All right, well, that was Bryce Clover of the New Deal 2.0.
You are about to learn one of the biggest secrets in the history of the world. It's a secret that has huge effects for everyone who lives on this planet. Most people can feel deep down that something isn't quite right with the world economy, but few know what it is. Gone are the days where a family can survive on just one paycheck. Every day it seems things are more and more out of control. Yet only one in a million understand why. You are about to discover a system that is ultimately responsible for most of the inequality in the world today. The powers that be do not want you to know about this. And this system is what has kept them at the top of the financial food chain for the past 100 years. Learning this will change your life because it will change the choice that you make. If enough people learn, it will change the world. Because it will change the system. For this is the biggest hidden secret of the planet. Never in human history has so many been plundered by so few. And it's all accomplished through this, the biggest scam in the history of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
They say that money doesn't grow on trees, but the truth is that the modern banking system creates currency far faster than trees can grow. Most people don't have a clue how currency is created. Economists and bankers make it sound so complex that people think they can't understand it. But I'm going to strip our monetary system down to its essence so that you can see the scam behind the curtain and just how it works. Every modern society creates currency in pretty much the same way. But since the U.S. dollar is the majority of the world's currency, I'm going to use the United States as an argument. It all starts when some politician says, vote for me and I'll make sure the government provides you more free stuff than my opponent does. But there's no such thing as a free lunch. So to provide that supposedly free stuff, the politicians vote for the country to spend more than it is. This is called deficit spending. To pay for that deficit spending, the Treasury borrows currency by issuing a bond. So what's a bond? If you think about it, a bond is really nothing but a glorified IOU. It's a pretty piece of paper with numbers printed on it that says, loan me $1 trillion today, and I promise over a 10-year period I'm going to pay you back that $1 trillion plus interest. But what you need to understand is that Treasury bonds are our national debt. These glorified IOUs are to be paid back by you and I and our descendants through future taxation. Therefore, when the government issues a bond, it steals prosperity out of the future so that it can spend it today. The Treasury then holds a bond auction, and the world's largest banks show up and compete to buy a part of our national debt and make a profit on it by earning interest. You'll notice that as we move through this process, the big banks are there, taking a cut every step of the way. This isn't by chance, as you'll see shortly. Then, through a shell game called open market operations, the banks get to sell some of those bonds to the Federal Reserve at a profit. To pay for the bonds, the Federal Reserve opens up its big old check and writes bad, bogus, counterfeit checks that should balance because they're going on an account that always has a zero balance. There isn't one penny in there. To quote from the Boston Federal Reserve, when you or I write a check, there must be sufficient funds in our accounts to cover that check. But when the Federal Reserve writes a check, there is no bank deposit on which that check is drawn. When the Federal Reserve writes a check, it is created. The Fed then hands over the check to the bank, and at this point, currency springs into existence. The banks then take that and buy more bonds at the next Treasury auction. But what is a check? A check is also an IOU. When you write a check, you're making a note that says, here's my IOU for cash. All you have to do is go to the bank and pick it up. Now, it's very, very important to understand that, because we're going to come back later to show you the devastating effect this has on you. The Treasury issues IOUs, bonds. The banks then buy those IOUs with currency. The Federal Reserve then writes IOUs, checks, and hands them to the bank in exchange for the Treasury's IOUs, the bonds. And currency is created. So what's really happening is the Federal Reserve and the Treasury are just swapping IOUs, using the banks as middlemen, and abracadabra, presto, currency magically springs into existence. This process repeats and repeats over and over again, enriching the bank and indebting the public by raising the national debt. The end result is that there's a buildup of bonds at the Federal Reserve and currency at the Treasury. This process is also where all paper is. The Federal Reserve and the government mistakenly call it basic because they didn't watch episode 1 of this before. And they don't know the difference between money and currency. But I will correctly refer to it as base currency because it is not money. It is currency, as we've learned, there's a big difference. Money has to be a store of value to maintain its purchasing power over a long period of time. We learned in episode 1 earlier in our history, our paper currency is just a function. It was a representation for real money of intrinsic value, the gold and silver held on deposit of the Treasury. You could walk into any bank and select your currency, like, say, a $20 bill, and redeem it for real money, $20 bill. But now, this base currency with IOU back here is really nothing but a receipt or a claim check on an IOU, that bond. So it's really nothing but a supply of money. The Treasury then deposits the newly created currency in the various branches of the government. And the politicians say, hey, thanks for that. And the government does some deficit spending on public works, social programs, and war. The government employees, contractors, and soldiers then deposit their pay with them.
Now, this may come as a shock to you, but when you deposit your currency with the bank, you're not actually depositing into an account that's basically held in trust. Instead, you're actually loaning the bank your currency. And within certain legal limits, they can do with it pretty much anything they choose. This includes gambling in the stock market and lending it out for a profit, of course. Now, this is where the insurance currency creation really is, because this is where something called fractional reserve lending comes into play. Fractional reserve lending is exactly what it says. The banks are allowed to reserve only a fraction of your deposit and loan the rest out. Although reserve ratios may vary, I'm going to use a 10% reserve ratio as our example. If you deposit $100 a year, the bank can legally take $90 of it and loan it out without telling you. The bank must hold $10 of your deposit in reserve just in case you want some of it. These reserves are called bulk cash. But why does your bank account still say you have $100 if the bank has stolen $90 of it? Because the bank left IOUs it created called bank credit in its place. Now, I know this sounds crazy, but here it is in black and white from the Fed. Commercial banks create checkbook money when they grant a loan simply by adding new deposit dollars in accounts on their books in exchange for a borrower's IOU. These are nothing but numbers that the banks type into their computers. And even though these bank credit IOU numbers are very different from base currency because they only exist in computers, they are still currency. So now there is $190 in currency. Now, the reason people take out loans from the bank is twice. They're going to buy a house or a car or something like that. So the borrower takes the $90 the bank loaned him from your account, and he pays the seller of the item. But then the seller deposits that currency into his account, and his bank loans out 90% of that and leaves bank credit numbers in its place. So now there's $271. This process repeats and repeats until under a 10% reserve ratio, an initial deposit of just $100 can create up to $1,000 of bank credit, all backed by $100 of bulk cash, just 10%. But as I said, reserve ratios vary wildly. On some deposits, it's 10%, on others, it's 3%, and on some forms of deposits, reserve requirements are zero. The result is that the expansion of the currency supply by the bank is far greater than even this example would lead you to believe. So once again, when currency is deposited in the bank gets lent out, and then it gets redeposited and relent, redeposited and relent, redeposited and relent over and over again, creating bank credit all the way. This is where the vast majority of our currency supply comes from. In fact, 92 to 96% of all currency in existence is created not by the government, but here in the banking system. Now, massive amounts of currency spewing into society may at first sound like a fun idea. That is, until you remember one of the most important hidden secrets of money from episode one, that the prices of everyday goods and services act as a sponge on an expanding currency. The more currency we have, the more prices rise. This is where inflation comes from. The true definition of inflation is an expansion of the currency supply. Rising prices are merely a symptom. So our entire currency supply is nothing but a couple of bucks whipped up in this hocus-pocus scam where the Treasury and the Federal Reserve swap glorified IOUs and a bunch of numbers that the banks just type into their computers. That's it. That's our entire currency supply. It's nothing but a supply of numbers. Some of them printed, most of them typed. And there is nothing else. But if you thought that was crazy, get ready to enter the twilight zone of modern economics. We work for some of that currency. Trade wealth is your time. So we trade away moments of our lives, hour by hour, day by day, year by year, for numbers that somebody printed on pieces of paper or just typed into a computer. Now those numbers represent our blood, sweat, tears, labor, our years, and time. We are what gives the currency itself. But here comes the really cool job. We work hard so that we can pay some of that money, so that we can pay the tax collectors in the United States, known as the IRS. They then turn it over to the Treasury so that the Treasury can pay the principal plus interest on that bond that the Federal Reserve bought with a check drawn on nothing in it. Now let's do a recap on this section, because this is where the system begins for God, you and I, at scale. Much of our taxes are not used for schools, roads, and public services, but to pay interest on bonds that the Fed loser bought with a check drawn in an account that has nothing in it. The Federal Reserve is committing fraud. But here's one of the biggest secrets of them all. Before the establishment of the Federal Reserve, there was no need for personal investment. The Federal Reserve was created in 1913, and that very same year, the Constitution was amended to allow income. Do you really think this is just a coincidence? Ask yourself how much income tax you've paid over your life. Much of it has been silently siphoned away into the hands of those who own the system. Yes, this system has owners. Who they are is an even bigger secret that we'll get to shortly. But first, we need to understand the mumbo-jumbo of the so-called debt ceiling. It's all based on a huge paradox. There was interest due on that bond, and there was interest due on every one of those loans that the banks made. That means that there is interest due on every dollar in existence. Let me ask you something. If you borrow the very first dollar in existence, and that's the only dollar that exists on the planet, but you promise to pay it back plus another dollar's worth of interest, where do you get the second dollar to pay the interest? The answer is that you have to borrow that one into existence and promise to pay it back with interest as well. So now there are $2 in existence, but you owe $4, and so on and so on. The result is there is never enough currency to pay the debt. There is always more debt in the system than there is currency in existence to pay the debt. Therefore, the whole system is impossible. It is final. It will come to an end. What would happen if the government stopped borrowing to do deficit spending? Are the payments on those treasury bonds going to stop? What would happen if the public stopped borrowing and going deeper into debt? Are your house car payments going to stop? No. There is a payment due every month on the principal plus the interest on every dollar in existence, and those payments do not stop. If we stop borrowing, then no new currency is created to replace the currency that we use to make those payments. Whether you're making a payment on a loan or paying tax to make a payment on a bond, the portion of the payment that goes to pay off the principal extinguishes that portion of the debt. But the debt also extinguishes the currency. Currency and debt are like matter and antimatter. When they meet, they annihilate each other. If we just pay off the principal only on all the loans and bonds that exist, the entire currency supply just vanishes. So if we don't go deeper into debt every year, look what happens. The whole thing goes into a deflationary collapse under the weight of those debts. Politicians and pundits alike talk about balancing the budget, paying down the debt, and living within our means. They don't understand that that is deflationary. It is impossible to do under our current monetary system without collapsing the whole economy. This is why any talk of a debt ceiling is not only ridiculous, it's delusional. The system is designed to require ever-increasing levels of debt just to continue. And that's why politicians will always kick the can down the road and raise this so-called debt ceiling over and over again, until the whole system finally collapses under its own weight. In other words, they don't want it to collapse on their watch. The founding fathers of the United States knew the dangers of central banking and fought to free themselves from this very thing. The Revolutionary War started out with a tax revolt, but now we must pay tax just to have a monetary system. Having just suffered through the hyperinflation of the Continental Bank, which was turned into oblivion to finance the Revolutionary War, they understood the dangers of fiat currency and debt-based monetary. So to protect future generations from institutional theft, out-of-control government, they wrote into the Constitution that only gold and silver can be money, for the simple fact that you can't print. Our current system is not only unconstitutional, but it robs us of the liberty and prosperity our forefathers fought and died for. We are all feeling the effects of ignoring the Constitution right now. By forcing more currency into circulation, our purchasing power is diluted. Inflation powers and benefits those who create the currency and receive it first, as they get to spend it into circulation before it has an effect on the economy. The stealing purchasing power from you and transferring it to the banks and the government